Colorado Springs, Colorado. This is the USA Volleyball Show, and here are your hosts, Clarence Hughes and Stephen Munson.
Well, hello there, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the USA Volleyball Show. We are the official podcast of, you guessed it, USA Volleyball. How does my advertising voice sound? No, it's very similar to my normal voice, but yeah.
Sounds great.
Advertisers out there, we're ready for you. Anyone, really anyone.
Honestly, anyone.
What, hit us up. Hit us up.
How long have you... I just noticed your hat in your background on top of that, on top of the volleyball.
I'm just going to start putting some products back there and just see if it gets mites. Yeah.
Yeah, no. Oh, those sponsors. I'm just kidding.
We'll probably see Mizuno at the... little teaser at the ABCA convention. Maybe we'll have a little chat with them.
Too soon. Just kidding. The cat's out the bag. Ah, where's PK? I'm just kidding.
I think we mentioned it last episode too. So
we did. Yeah.
All good. All good. How's your weekend?
It was good. We had our staff holiday party. Actually, right, yesterday for the Edge, and we also had our USA Volleyball staff holiday party this past Thursday, which is a lot of fun, at the U.S. Olympic and Paralympic Museum. That was a really great venue, by the way.
Great venue for the party. Yeah. Yeah. And your voice sounds pretty good still after emceeing that night. Did you also emcee your team?
I did not.
The party too?
No, we had our white elephant, had some food, and we all just played some ball. Okay. So it was a lot of fun. But I did not have to do any emceeing, which is a little relief, you know. We'll be talking enough in Tampa as it is.
Yeah, I'm excited. I walked away with one of the big raffle prizes.
In
our holiday party, the Hypervolt. Isn't it a Theragun? Is that?
What? No.
You kept saying Theragun.
Well, hey, you know, I kind of read what's on the list here. You know, hey, the kind of like I said, we read a draw lock and they named Stacy. But
I guess we lost Hyper Ice as a sponsor then, so
it's okay. Man.
They're our bad. Our bad.
So our fault. We'll do better next time. But I will make sure the proper product is on the paper that I read. But a lot of fun things happen at the holiday party. Good times, good vibes, and
yeah.
I don't know why I do this. But yeah,
and a great MC too. Great job doing that.
Jamie,
it's not an easy job. Not an easy job, but you crushed it.
Appreciate it. Thank you. Next year, I don't know, you might have to co-host.
Ooh. Get a little podcast co-host going.
Little podcast co-host action. A little back and forth banter. One side of the room, other side of the room. Oh, no, we'll see. Ideas, you know.
Running some jokes. Yeah. I like it. I'll work on my dad jokes. Perfect.
Perfect.
I have one thing that I need to bring up to you. I'm looking to make a change for 2024. Personal change.
Oh, scared.
I think I'm gonna shave my head. I'm thinking about losing the flow. I'm sorry I just dropped that bomb on you. Dropped that bomb on the podcast, but yeah. Yeah, why not make a change?
How does it take it? 2023, you heard it here.
Yeah.
I'm about to shave the
flow. I think I'm done with it. I'm done with my hair falling out all over the house. I think I'm done. And Teller is pulling my hair a lot now.
That's where there it is. All
right. So I think I'm looking for a change, and I think I'm going to... Mustache is staying, right. Curtis.
Okay, mustache
is staying. But I think I'm
more serious question.
Cut the hair.
That's the thing about that.
She's nervous. She's nervous, but she's supportive. She's actually been saying, maybe I'll do it too. Because, of course, Teller also pulls her hair as well. But big changes coming, potentially.
We'll definitely keep you updated. January 1st. Right there happening, or just like
maybe even before Christmas.
We can't even finish the year. Wow. Before Christmas. What a Christmas crowd. That'd be insane.
Yeah, we'll see.
You're going to have to take your headshot. Nobody's going to recognize
you. I will have to retake my headshot once again because I've changed my look so many times. I have headshots where I have like a full beard, headshots where I have short hair, no mustache. You know,
that just gave me the like an idea. Like you should, we should just do a little slideshow of, you know, Steve Ines history.
Headshots, yeah,
you know,
yeah. I like that, yeah, because there's a lot of them.
Yeah. I only have two, but it's very different. So I can only imagine, you know, how many hairstyles you've gone through.
But yeah, so big changes coming. I'll keep you updated. But yeah, just kind of wanted to gauge your reaction here on the podcast.
I'm nervous. I'm right here. I'm nervous too. I'd say I joined you. You know, shave mine, but I don't
think care. You're more nervous than my wife is.
what are the friends of the pod going to think? You know, you jump on. Like, hey, what's up? Good to see you again. They're gonna be like, who are you? You're not Steven.
I should have done it. I don't think I'm not gonna do it. But I should have done it before ABC and just freaked everybody out.
Just show up. We're all on the same Denver flight.
Steven's
Mrs. Flight.
Steven's not on the flight.
Just gonna be. Oh man, that is crazy. Okay.
Yeah. Well. Yeah. But I'll keep you updated, and we'll see what happens. But let's just jump into the show now that I just dropped that bomb on you. But before we get into it, if you missed our last episode, go back and check it out. Episode 79 features UCLA women's volleyball head coach and U.S. women's national team assistant coach, Alfie Repp. We have a fun conversation with Alfie, covering everything from his time competing with the men's national team, coming full circle to now coaching the women's national team, his excitement now leading the UCLA women's program, and we even dip into favorite karaoke songs. All that and more in episode 79. Check it out now on all podcast platforms, and you can watch the video episode as well on our YouTube and USA Volleyball website. Now, it's time for news with Hughes.
Yes, indeed. Big weekend for our U.S. beach teams. First up, congratulations to former guests of the pod, Taryn Kloth and Kristen Nuss, on winning gold at the Beach Pro Tour Finals in Doha. Up next, we have Staying on the Beach, by the way. Also, another shout out to Deanna Kraft and Molly Turner for winning gold, and also Jordan Hope and James Shaw on taking silver at the Norseca San Salvador event. Again, congratulations to both teams. This one right here, I'm very excited for. USA Volleyball announces two pilot divisions for the 2024 Girls 11-13 Junior National Championship in Dallas, Texas, Stevens' hometown. Oh, yes. The great event place. Will, it's all right there, I guess. No, I'm just kidding. I actually really enjoy Dallas. A lot of fun. I'm really glad we're going back there this year. But the event will test the 10 Patriot and the 12 Patriot divisions to gauge interest and participation at the younger levels in hopes of expanding the national championship to more teams and continue the growth of the sport. I'm excited, but stressed out all at the same time with more teams.
It's really exciting.
More stress. I know. I'm very excited. And then I can't wait for the 10 Patriots. The 10th
is going to be a lot of fun.
It's going to be crazy.
Mm-hmm. The 11th is a lot of fun, and 12s too. But
yeah,
those matches are earlier in the tournament, and they're always like packed house too, which is absolutely a good time.
Do you remember? I'm totally going on tangent here, but do you remember what was it in? Shoot. It wasn't Vegas in 21. Where were we? Indianapolis, where we had the 11 final, the first one, and just the bleachers were packed. Am I correct there? Or was it?
I think that's right. It may have been the year. Oh no, it may have been Indianapolis.
It was Indianapolis. Yeah. We were at Indy, and at 11 final.
That was right before we made it for that final.
Packed. Yes. That's when you came down.
And then I had COVID.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. At least you saw the 11s, and then you unfortunately got sick. But it was an insane final. Those were packed. And they'll let you a really good match. So I really can't wait to see what the 10s and the 12 Patriots. Yes. Really good.
Younger divisions, those younger age groups. Very good.
I know.
Very good.
Again, this makes me excited to see what the 10 Patriot and 12 Patriot can do. But continuing on, because I feel like we can talk about that all day. The U.S. men's and women's national teams are getting settled with their pro teams overseas. Remember, be sure to check out the weekly updates on USA Volleyball's website to stay in the know and follow their pro club seasons. Dun, 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 dun. The Final Four is set for the 2023 NCAA Division I Women's Volleyball Championship. Congratulations to Nebraska, Pittsburgh, Wisconsin, and Texas on advancing to this stage of the tournament. You can watch the semifinals on December 14th on ESPN and the National Championship on December 17th on ABC. If you guys can pan over in one of the corners on the media level and take a screenshot of Stephen, Curtis, and myself, we will appreciate it. Yeah, but you know, that's where we're going to be sitting during those matches as well. But again, good luck to those teams heading over to Tampa. We will see you there because the USA Volleyball Show is headed back to the ABCA convention and the NCAA championship this year. We are so excited to be back, and we are also so excited to not be driving this time. We cannot wait to catch up with many of our friends in the volleyball world. Follow along the action on US Volleyball social medias, and for more on all of the latest news, just visit usavolleyball.org.
Steve, excited to have excited to have continuing that NCAA conversation, excited to have the matches on ESPN, yes, and then the final, the championship on ABC this year. I think it got pushed back a day to make that happen, but that's awesome. That's really great for the tournament. Yeah, great for the tournament, great for the sport too. So excited to have that. Those matches on big networks. All right, let's introduce, well, before we introduce today's guests, first off, thank you to our guest host, BJ Evans, USA Volleyball Communications Manager, for joining us on the interview today. We have a legend on this week's show, 1968 Olympian Lori Lewis Havel. We learn about her background, including what it was like growing up in California in the early days of the beach volleyball boom there. She talks about her new book, My Unusual Life, an autobiography that chronicles a determined spirit and twists and turns. In her book, she goes into her experience at the Olympic Games, working for Architectural Digest magazine, meeting many celebrities in her time with the magazine and in her time and experience with the at the Olympic Games. Her time of healing after an abusive marriage, then finding love again in a decades-long marriage filled with humor and happiness, and so much more in that book. Her book is available now at Barnes & Noble and Amazon. But for now, listen to our conversation with Lori.
And thank you, Lori, for joining us today. We're here to talk about the book you just published, My Unusual Life. Mm-hmm. What motivated you to tell your life story?
I don't know many people that have done a deep dive into sports and then a deep dive into art, design, and writing. Had a miserable 9-month marriage and then met their soulmate. My life has kind of been opposites, thankfully ending up on the good side.
want to let folks know that the book covers your time on the Olympic team, your early time playing volleyball on the beach, and then joining the indoor Olympic team, and then goes on to talk about your life after the Olympics.
Yes. Definitely. I wanted to get the story out of what happened. What was it like being an athlete at the Olympics? What was it like being on staff in the early days of Architectural Digest? Because it wasn't, I'm sure, anything like today. And then the magic of meeting my soulmate after a rather yucky marriage.
Well, I think it's a good time to jump into asking you about your volleyball history, but not only that, how you were introduced to the game, both on the indoor and on the beach side of things.
My godmother who went to high school with my mother, she used to play volleyball at State Beach and used to take her son, Steve, and me when we were about 3 and 4 or 4 and 5. Obviously, we didn't get near the court. We were a little too little for that. But it was intriguing to me. Later on, when I got into high school, our coach brought Mary Jo Pepler and Mary Perry over right from the 64 Olympics. And they explained volleyball, and I was mesmerized. The fast speed, the split second timing, all of the stuff that went into it just totally captured me. Believe it or not, in a small school with 260 girls, one girl had missed the Olympics by 0.2 seconds, and another girl had played doubles in Wimbledon. Wow. So it was a sports team, you know, sportsy kind of group. And I was taking tennis lessons at the time, but I thought, oh no, this is just too exciting.
Was there anything specifically that those women said when they visited your school that they, that like captured you, that really got you interested into volleyball?
I don't know that the school, but the coach had played volleyball before. And she encouraged me. She said, you ought to go try out for a club team. And I'm like, I'm only 14. And she said, go do it. So I did. And they said, you're on. And I went, oh. Yeah. But there wasn't an overall sports. If anything, it was academics and drama and different things like that. That was much more stressed.
That's pretty cool. That they're, like you mentioned, there was so much athletic success at the Olympic level in that small pool of people, of students.
When I look back, I kind of went, wow, that's got to be kind of unusual.
Mm-hmm. That's really cool. So you played both beach and indoor, and that's something that we talk a lot about and encourage our younger athletes to play both. But did you find that, you know, beach helped you on the indoor side and then vice versa as well?
Oops. I started playing indoors. And then when I was like 15, 16, I went down to the beach, where at least I knew my godmother. But it was a kind of a small group. They all knew each other. You could tell by the cars in the parking lot exactly who was there that day. And I started playing, thinking this would be fun. Beach is so different, strategically different than indoors. Not that you can't use the strategies in both games, but you don't get that same lift from the sand. You don't. You do have to learn how to make it around the sand, especially get the ball over the net no matter what. And you could call timeout for sand, which was important for me because I usually tended to play with my mouth wide open.
Getting a lot of sand everywhere. Whenever I was playing beach, or whenever I played beach, I feel like that sand follows you for a long time. It's in your car, it's in your clothes. It's
everywhere. I'll say it does.
In your mouth, yeah.
Well, that, and I learned, I think at the time, and I have no idea what it is now, but at the time they said women hit the ball at 90 miles an hour. So you get hit in the face just once, and you learn how to, no matter what position you're in, to get your hands up in front of your face to protect yourself. Yeah.
Did you prefer one or the other? Did you prefer beach over indoor, indoor over beach?
You know, I loved beach volleyball. But when I started really getting into indoors, you missed, we were traveling. So I missed summer seasons. And yes, I was sorry that I missed them, but we were traveling to the Pan Am Games or, well, Tokyo was in Japan. I mean, was in January. So it just kind of took all of your time up.
In your book, Lori, you talk about the LA beach subculture of the 1960s. And we were just wondering if you had some interesting safe for work stories about that time.
It was kind of interesting. There were people who played on the beach at Chautauqua, at State Beach, at Chautauqua and PCH, like every day. There was Alti Cohen and his wife Roz, played with Fran, my godmother. Selznick was down there sometimes, Gene Selznick. Gene Brunicardi. Then you had people like Ron Van Hagen and Ron Lang who would also come. And then it started growing. Younger people came in, like Mike Bright, Butch May, different people, even me, trying to dip my toe in there. And Kathy Gregory, and I could go on. I'm sure you've read the names before or met the people before. And when that happened, it was interesting because you could sit on one side of the beach and watch people on the other side of the beach talking about you. I think there was a little bit of jealousy when some of the new young ones came in, and they were very good. You also had a break with from the oh-so-modest bathing suits of the late 50s and early 60s. All of the women wore little bikinis, and they were selling them on the beach, and they had new patterns and everything constantly. The guys still wore loose trunks or jams, depending on when they were last in Hawaii. and it was kind of a close-knit small group, which followed as they started shifting. When they shifted to Muscle Beach, and then they started actually having tournaments and stuff on Saturdays in South Bay in different places, they all just followed along, with the exception of some of the originals from State Beach. But there were some pretty good friendships formed there. I know at one point in time, Gene Brunicardi, who was a very good player, became ill. And one of the guys that had played there set it up for her to be taken care of for the rest of her life. Not forever and ever. She was ill. So it was like he made sure she was taken care of, which made me feel good. It was like, okay, it was a good group. It definitely was a good group. So, but you could, any given day, you could go, okay, Johnette's car, Selznick's Cadillac, and just go right down the line. You knew exactly who was at the beach.
Yeah, I love what I heard about all the trend-setting fashion you guys said there too. I think that's pretty cool.
Absolutely, you know, that you watch on the other side, and maybe it was Fran, I don't know, or Johnette, who would pull out fabric swatches. You know, like how many bikinis would you like?
So, can you just talk a little bit about, you know, just some of the beach greats and, you know, those, you know, big time names that you maybe looked up to during the time?
It was, I would say, Ron Van Hagen and Ron Lang. And I think that Ron Lang hooked up with Linda Phillips eventually from South Bay. But they were terrific. I think I played in a doubles tournament, the State Beach Open, with Vogelsang, who was all arms. He screamed the whole time, not necessarily at me, just in general. Not a real great courtside manner, but he had arms that just didn't quit. So it didn't matter where he was. He could get the ball over the net as if he were, you know, just pounding it. Then you had Mike Bright, who was very good, and his wife, Patty, whom I played with on the 68 team. And his mother was on the committee, which chose teams. Let's see, who else did you have? Kathy Gregory, who was very good at doubles and managed to win a lot of tournaments. I think she and I won the Manhattan Beach Open one year, or like the second Manhattan Beach Open. I go way back.
That's cool.
So they were... they were always interesting. There were always new people coming in. Butch May came in. So it was fascinating to me to watch his daughter come up and play beach volleyball. And different people like that, almost like the next, well, was the next generation.
Yeah, that must be cool to see, like, yeah, the generations after you and how beach has grown and the culture has grown. And have you been to many beach events recently or like seen like what it looks like now versus what you remember from back when you were playing?
Well, when the group moved from State to Muscle, then they went down south of to Muscle Beach, south of the pier. That's when at the time it was only us. It was only the volleyball players. You really didn't have a huge outside crowd. When we got to Muscle Beach, we all became hooked on hot dog on a stick lemonade, among other things.
Yes.
So good.
Pre-Gatorade, that came next. And it was interesting to watch it evolve. People, they were in a more... populated beach then. So people started watching and it was like, oh, in fact, you did have Wilt Chamberlain came down and played and sweet guy, really nice. Just was, I'm sorry to say this, not cut out for volleyball. As hard as he tried, it was just not his sport. But he came down. And there were several other actors, too. One guy whose name escapes me. But they came down. So people started watching. People started coming. And it was developing kind of a following. That's when you started to get tournaments that went up and down that drew a lot of people. Mm-hmm. Not a lot, but started, you know, drawing people and then became larger and larger.
Yeah, that's pretty cool that your small group of players just moving beaches attracted fans and allowed you to start tournaments. And as you just mentioned, celebrities, too, started to come out and check it out, too. So that's pretty. Yeah.
With all due respect to Will Chamberlain, whom I very much
It's so, a good thing you had a pretty good career on the basketball court, though.
But it's good to know you wasn't good up for volleyball, right?
So, and it was interesting because when they started having tournaments, you started meeting people down from the South Bay, and then they would come up for tournaments here. So it started snowballing.
Mm-hmm.
And so, different things were, you know, like Gatorade started to become associated with it. I've watched a few beach tournaments and I look at all the people in the stands go, oh, my goodness, what is that? Mm-hmm. So it's interesting.
Aside from like the competition itself, what do you think was what multiple things do you think were contributing aspects to, you know, that snowballing, you know, fan base and that culture that kind of started to build?
I think maybe like me, when Mary Jo and Mary Perry came and introduced us to the game, people didn't know what it was. They thought about it as, you know, gym class in middle school. And when they saw actually what it was about, then they were fascinated and mesmerized. And California and Hawaii were at the time the two strongest players groups. So you all of a sudden had more people that you were meeting and more people coming in. And that was the actual makeup of the 68 team. They're both the men's and women's team. I wrote it in the book. I may get the numbers exactly wrong, not exactly straight. Was like mostly California, two Hawaiians, et cetera. They had parallel people from those places on the beach or on the in the U.S. from Hawaii and California. And we would do kind of clinics across the country, different places, depending on where we were, if we were traveling, just to introduce people. I was looking through, I think, the 1966 and 1967 volleyball, official volleyball book. I don't even know if they have them anymore. Anyway, it was like all these teams from the Midwest and from all these different places. And I keep that, you know, I was thinking back thinking, wow, I think except at Nationals, you never saw anybody from any of the other places. And they were not quite as advanced or as dedicated, I think, as Hawaii and California. So they weren't a huge threat.
Yeah, kind of wanting to move over to your indoor side of your career, too. And you wrote in your book that you played for a club, Shamrocks, and I believe you mentioned they were you were a teenager and you were playing with older women. Is that correct?
Yes.
With that club, what was that like? Yeah.
And I was playing with people who were high school coaches and teachers and middle school coaches and teachers. And I just kind of thought, oh, OK, we get to deal with them as teammates, not as teachers. Mm-hmm. Not that I was disrespectful. I don't mean that. But none of them ever pulled rank on me. Thank you.
Oh, wow.
Which was very nice. We just played and played. They finally, you know, accepted me for who and what I was. And the fact that I was such a shrimp, I wasn't a shrimp, obviously. I was like 5'10", 5'11", but that I was so young. And I just loved it. One of the things I loved them, I remember being in at Redondo Beach High School one Saturday before a tournament. And I think there were 150 volleyballs in the air at one given time. I was counting them and it just thrilled me. I was like, oh, this is wonderful. So it started, it just kept things going for me. I just loved it. But yes, they were all very nice to me. And when we traveled, like, as I mentioned before, in 66, the committee came in. These were the people who chose the team. Patty Bright's mother was one of them, Bertha, very nice lady. But, you know, I'm 16 going, who are these people? And yes, they watched practices and everything and chose the team. And I was chosen to go to Mexico, which is how my mother remembers I left the house. I moved out by the airport and I flew to Mexico. Actually, we flew to Tijuana. And then we boarded another plane and flew to Mexico City. But along the way, some of the life's lessons that I saw, first of all, were the shanties along the Tijuana airport that just still stick in my mind. So I got kind of an eyeful of different things along the way that I'm, part of me is very naive, but it made me not so naive.
How do you think you got chosen for that first team? What position were you playing? What were you doing to stand out to the committee?
First of all, I have what they said were very good hands. My theory is I have tight tendons, which so I wasn't throwing the ball a lot. I also could spike. And there was a time, that was a time where you had some older players who were kind of phasing out. who, I mean, because it takes a bit of stamina, let me say, to play volleyball as hard as you can. So those people were phasing out, and there were several new ones, newbies coming in. And I think it was timing. And that helped me a lot.
Who are some of those, and you mentioned, like, you know, some of those, you know, older players that may have been either fading out or, you know, just along those lines, who are some of those, you know, women's volleyball athletes that have inspired you personally?
Mary Jo Pepler, for one. She was 6 feet tall, sculptured. She was like poetry in motion, just incredible. She also, the second year I played with the Renegades. That was Mary Jo and Mary Perry. The Shamrocks, the first team, was Jane Ward. A little more conservative, very steady, very good. I'm not putting anything down. But the Renegades, Mary Jo, Mary Perry, were Renegades. They railed at the committees. They railed at the rules. They just, you know, that was just them. Mary Jo was phenomenal, a phenomenal athlete, also extremely strong. When we traveled to Detroit for the Nationals one year, she said, oh, no problem. I'll pick up all your jerseys and we'll wash them and we'll all have clean jerseys tomorrow. Well, she washed them with the red shorts. So we then had pink shirts and people were teasing her. And she goes, if you do that again, I'll give you the spin around. Now, none of us was petite, but Mary Jo could pick you right up over her head, twirl you around and throw you on the bed, which was affectionately known as the spinning up. All done in fun and everything else. No one got hurt. It was not bullying. But we did give her a very hard time for doing things like washing white shirts with red shorts. Mary Perry, on the other hand, she and I used to go horseback riding, but Mary Perry was one of these people who, when she felt a little uptight, she'd go out and run 9 miles.
Wow.
That's what I said. I was jealous because she did it with such ease. And I was out there running 2 to 4 miles going, oh, gasp. But it was just fluid with her. So the two of them, along with Marilyn McCreevy and who recently died, poor Marilyn, and a few others, they worked very hard on taking the newest inventions in the game, whether it's a Japanese rule or a Russian dive or anything else, or a different approach to hitting, and then would break it down and teach it to all the rest of us. And it was great. So, I mean, they were just phenomenal that way.
Nine miles. I get a little winded just walking up the stairs in my house.
Thank you.
In our office, you have to walk upstairs, and I was gasping for air. I need some water.
And 9 miles is insane. So fluidly, it was just like, Mary, how do you do that? Mm-hmm. Yeah, she was our comedian. She had voices and nickname most of the people on the team. Nancy Owens was Otis because of the bib overalls she wore one day. Mickey was Mickey McFoo. Sharon was Feather because she just covered the whole court so quickly and fast. It was fat, and she would talk in from Donald Duck to whatever voices. She was always right in there. So we did not lack for laughter.
Mm-hmm. What was your nickname? Did you have one?
Pardon?
Did you have one? A nickname?
I didn't have a nickname. They must have thought I was too straight or something. I mean, I was friends with Mary Jo and Mary Perry. Mary Jo came and spent time at our house. She and I wrote on the off season, would write poetry and sit and talk philosophy until the wee hours of the morning. So I connected with her on other levels. But no, they never gave me a nickname. Sorry. If they did, I'd tell you.
Oh, it sounds like a great kind of family atmosphere that you had on that team, and then relationships too.
Yeah.
It was, especially when you're spending months together.
Yeah. Yeah, you learn about each other real quick and learn how to live with each other really quick.
You do. So
yeah,
it was and it was very entertaining. Even Jane Ward, I'm going to digress into another question here, but when we were training for the Olympics, women in sports were kind of suspect. They didn't know that much. They were experimenting a lot. We all had to sign affidavits that we would continue in the program. And this was early on, even though we might develop muscles. So, which we all signed. So one day we're in training camp and a box of protective bras. They were two Madonna-like pointy cups held together with an elastic strap. And you were supposed to put these on over your regular bras. So we all did. And then, of course, we did Russian dives and Japanese rolls, and they all inverted. Most uncomfortable. So all you could hear in the gym was this pop, 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 pop as we uninverted them. And Jane Ward, who also had a good sense of humor, picked one up, put water in hers, and said, "Here's to protective bras." And that was the end of that. We did not go near them again. Most uncomfortable. So there were lots of things like that. Even in weight training, when we were in Long Beach, we'd go in. I don't know if it's two nights a week. I forget how many nights. And the gym keeper, the weight trainer, training room person would say, "Okay, guys, clear out the rooms reserved." And the guys would all stop and wait to watch, because what are these girls doing in a weight room? And so we all walked in and we took the little slots in the universal weight machine and moved them up 200 pounds to 500 pounds. And the guys at the door were going, "Oh my God." Because it was routine for us to do leg press 500 pounds or more. So it was kind of something where people, the term jock got bandied about quite a bit because they weren't quite sure. Is this normal? Is this all women? So anyway, it was always interesting. Never boring. And people could make, I mean, if it wasn't one person, it was somebody else who had humor going. Fanny, who was from Hawaii, native Hawaiian, and Mickey were just great too. And we were all living together for months at a time. We had, I think, in the World Games and then Pan American Games and then, you know, in the Olympics, training that was months, and it was postponed because of the riots in Mexico City. So we were, we were in Long Beach, then we were in Tahoe and different places, and we still get along. We're all still friends, which I think says something.
Yeah. Moving on to talking about the Olympics. You attended UCLA for a year and then you dropped out to train full time. Yes. Was that decision difficult for you or how'd that go for you?
Basically, it wasn't difficult because I wanted both my education and the Olympics. And that was my window, I knew, for the Olympics. I was in a class at Marymount with 20 women who were so bright. I mean, every one of them got a scholarship, a this, a that, and the other thing. And when I got to UCLA, I was a little from 60 kids in a class to 33,000. I was a little overwhelmed. And I got into a psychology class that was 500 people in the class, and they were giving a final that was Multiple choice. You think that sounds easy. All four are correct. One is more correct than the others. And they were working really hard just to weed out anybody. And so I didn't open a book thinking, oh, my gosh, these people are all smart as the girls I went to school with. And I got a D. So that put me on probation. Now, that's when I said to Mom, I need to take time off school. Now, the first quarter I got back, I was off probation. I was fine. And I could have gotten a PhD. But, you know, it was that first kind of ice cold shock, like, oh, my gosh, all these people and everything else. So she said, yes, take the time off. And I did. And I think it was like right before nationals. And her friends just gave her the worst time. They said she'll never go back to school. She'll never do that. And I'm like, not so. Soon as I got back from the Olympics, I turned around, went back to UCLA. Actually, I took a class at a junior college because I wanted to see what that was like. And then went back to UCLA. Timing was off for quarters. So it wasn't that hard. I knew what I wanted, and I knew that that was my window to do it. We had nationals in May, as we usually did. And then pretty much, what, August, I think, was when training started. So it was like August to October. We were living together, or July through October, we were all living together. So the team. So stop me if I've got the wrong dates there. I've got them written down somewhere. I just don't have them seared into my memory now. But yeah, it was a very good group. Definitely. Some people did not like Harlan Cohen and had. So people like Linda Murphy and a few others just and Mary Jo just said, nope, not doing this. But it was, you know, everybody had kind of a tough time with Harlan at one point or another. So, I mean, I remember running extra laps because he said, you need to lose weight. And it was summer hot. I had lost probably 2 pounds of water weight. And I said, Harlan, it'll come right back when I drink water. And he goes, you're doing great. So the next day, of course, it came back. And so he made me run extra laps around the track. And I can still remember the hot tears of anger coming down my cheeks, just ready to, you know, have at him. But I was good.
Tell us a little more about those training camps. I know they sounded pretty brutal, but what was it like when you found out you had made the Olympic team?
It was extraordinary. I was in seventh heaven. I kept thinking, you know, I projected out, et cetera, after Tahoe, where the guys and the girls would get together in the little tiny cabin thing. After Tahoe, I was like looking for what's it going to be like. I was convinced that the sky would open up and a voice would talk to me. I wasn't sure what he'd say, but I was convinced that would be. And when I got down there, it was fascinating, start to finish. So many experiences. Let's see. When we got down there, we got into the village and they were letting some people into the village at that point. And people would stop and say, may I have your autograph? And I quickly turned around to see who was behind me because I'm like, nobody wants my autograph. And then they were, you kind of made the way around the village, checking it out. It was great. And I must say, I miss seeing the walkers. My understanding is they have to have a heel toe on the ground at all times, which gives them the cutest little wiggle. So you'd see these guys wiggling all through the village. And then the opening ceremonies, which I just couldn't wait for. We got there. They actually had logistics worked out. We managed to get there in, I think, an hour, 2 hours, 5 hours to get back there. But when it was over, so we get there on the field, we march around, and the Mexican people were so welcoming. And so wonderful when we came in. So you get on the field and you're in the after the Parade of Nations, and I forget who's the gentleman who said, okay, let the games begin. And they let balloons out, which caught on the lights. And then they let hundreds of doves out. And the guy next to me said, step under the tarp. And I didn't know, you different country, different sport. I don't know. I stepped under the tarp. And very glad I did, because those little avians left their cages and their marks everywhere. And all most athletes could do was duck. And it was just like, oh my gosh, now what? But things you don't, you know, things that you don't think about or anticipate or look at when you watch it on TV, you don't think, you know, 500 doves are going to fly over your head. Or like being in the Olympic Village where there wasn't one washing machine.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, 5,000 athletes and not one washing machine. So you can imagine people were flying their own flags everywhere. It's like their laundry was out, and for good reason, because you're working out 2 and 3 times a day. So it's like, oh, better get this dried, better get this washed. And once we got down there and started, it was great fun. You go to the international club, they had newspapers in every language. If you didn't speak somebody else's language, you had great gestures and things like that. And then you could catch a bus to any of the venues going. We were invited one night to the ambassador's house for a reception. And then 4 of us went out in the town, ended up at Shakey's. Yes, that was the only American thing down there. I'm sure other American companies have made it down there, but that was it. None of us spoke fluent Spanish, we did find out the cab driver's wife just had a baby. We congratulated him and did all that. You meet people in the international club, athletes of all different countries and sports. There's a wonderful cross-sport camaraderie or respect or whatever you want to say. It's not like people introduce you necessarily. Oh, hi, meet, you know, Tommy Smith, or I think it was John Carlos who won dressed in all African garb. I wish I knew what the country was, but I don't. Who won a jackpot for me in Reno on the way down. I went. even coming down, you see the absolute tremendous size of these athletes. That's not a negative, but flying down to Mexico City, there was one gentleman in the front of the plane with 3 seats to himself. And it was Randy Mattson, who was a shot putter, one for his body and one for each arm, and he filled them. And I was just like, oh my God. I had a tendency to hang out with the basketball team because I was going out with Mike Silliman, who was the captain. So, but he was busy talking to the Kentucky Colonels or something. They were looking to pick him up as soon as he got out of the military and or finished. And so I became good pals with Ken Spain, who was from Houston. Nicest chap, 6'9". And we would meet and do different things whatever happened. One night he came to me, goes, Lori, he was seeing a swimmer who's about 5 foot tall. He says, oh my gosh, I asked this girl out and I forgot we had a game. Could you take this note up to her room? So I quickly ran up to her room, left the note for her, and then I said, she's not up there. I couldn't hand it to her, but it's there. So somehow we ended up, all three of us, the swimmer, Ken Spain and me, having lunch or dinner in the refectory that night. Now, when they built the village, there were pyramids and they left them there. So the refectory was at the top of all these stairs with about, I don't know, 50 feet of gravel and all that stuff. It rained buckets when we were eating dinner. And there was a huge puddle. And so we start to leave and all these people are on the stairs. They're like, how am I going to get through this puddle? So Ken goes, okay, Lori, put your arm around this side, and swimmer, I forget her name, put your arm around this side and I'll carry you through. And I'm thinking, this is not a balanced fulcrum, no matter how you look at it. And he wouldn't take no for an answer, so we did. He walked us across that puddle, and his shoes, the top of his shoes, did not even get wet. And I was in awe. And he got a standing ovation from everybody around. This is a man who, when I first met him, I said, oh, Ken, why do you straddle every doorway? He said, because if I don't, I cold cock myself. And he showed me, if you didn't straddle the doorway, it hit him right here. And I thought, oh, my goodness. So just a shot putter came in one night. I'm blanking on his name. Wait a minute. I've got his name somewhere, but I can't find it. And he had just gotten a gold medal, and everybody in their factory was, you know, attaboy, and that's great, and just celebrating him. And he goes, I have this great coat hanger. Would anyone like it? He had a suit jacket on it or something he didn't need. And I said, I'll take it. So I put it in my suitcase and came home. Oh, my gosh. Nothing short of a tent would have fit on this. I didn't have a skirt in my closet that even could go straight out that fit on this coat hanger. So I started to realize how extraordinary so many of these people were, these athletes in how they were built. I mean, not only was his jacket probably custom made, but the coat hanger it was put on. All lovely people, so much fun to be around. It was just every time you turned around, there was another experience. So,
oh, you're on mute, Clarence.
I'm on mute again.
No, Clarence, no, you're good. You're good. That was totally my bad. You're good. Just mentioning during those the 68 games, you know. It's frustrating that, you know, the team didn't win a match. But in your book, you mention about how much fun you all had and how much, you know, that experience really, you know, meant something. Can you share, you know, maybe one or two of your best memories there? Or ones that just stood out, you know, they don't necessarily have to maybe be your best.
Well, for one was being carried down by Ken after dinner one night. We used to wear, if we didn't have full USA garb on or sweats, we had jackets or whatever. And fortunately, while the tickets were like huge and technically you were supposed to have one, we just sneaked in with the wide world of sports people right behind them, and which was great fun. I think track was the only thing you didn't need a ticket for. And it was great fun to just go and see different sports. I got to see swimming and met some swimmers. Inga Renner from East Germany, who defected to West Germany, whose parents at the time were still living in East Germany. Anyway, it was so fascinating to meet people from different cultures from all around the world, and all of whom, you know, were in the village. All of whom were in the village. The women had several buildings, I think three or four, with these very stern looking guards dressed in very strange stern looking uniforms. Even the doctors had to be accompanied to go up to see them, see a woman that was in one of these buildings. And you just, every day there was something, but we managed at the end to get, I got one of the things that I was able to do was give my eighth grade gym coach a tour, she and her husband, of the village. And I thought, how great is that? Obviously, it's a personal thing, but just every day there was something. Or my mom's best friend's niece came down there and I got her in and, you know, we walked around. We met when we went into the city. People would say, oh, what team? What are your chances, et cetera? We wish you luck. There was a family from the San Fernando Valley that took, father took a sabbatical, took his family down there. He drove us around when we had to go into town. Ian, the videographer, also did. But people were so genuinely nice, so genuinely friendly that it was like, it's a small world. No, I will not sing the song, but just that. It was just that feeling. People were just, there was an outpouring, especially to be in a different country. It was wonderful. So those are the kinds of things. One night, we drove the car. I think we had a game and we drove it back and it was raining and we didn't want to walk this whole huge way. So the girls in the car decided that I should be a sick athlete. I'm a rotten liar, guys. And as soon as the guard looked in to see if I was sick, I started laughing and they decided that was the end of my acting days. We would get somebody else athlete next time. So it was stuff like that every day where it was fun, very much fun.
Yeah, such a cool experience for you to get to experience that. And just the, like you mentioned, all the athletes from different sports too, and getting to mingle with them and see, you know, the different builds, like you talked about, the different builds for each sport too. It's pretty incredible.
Oh, yes, definitely. Definitely. And I don't know, perhaps you do, BJ, maybe you know, have there been many books written? I mean, I know, Tommy Smith and John Carlos have written books, but I doubt that those are the day-to-day behind the scenes of a regular athlete. I'm sure theirs is a little more politically charged, but I don't think there have been many books that, you know, write about this is what we did. This is what happened. These are the people we met. And then one night we had a match at about 4 o'clock, which would have gone maybe till 7 or 8 or maybe 3. Okay. We had a match. So right after the match, they pull Nina aside, 6 foot blonde, and say, you're wanted for drug testing. Now you don't think that's a big problem, except there's only one way they can do it. And that's with a urinalysis. So straight physiology tells you after you've just finished a match, you're coursing with adrenaline, you're really going strong. So 7 hours later, the guards took her back to the apartment. I mean, you know, they didn't do hair, they didn't do anything like that then, and they finally got one. So just the normal things that you would anticipate were kind of way out of whack. It's like, we were all rooting for Nina. It's like, come on, poor baby. 7 hours later, just to give her, you know, your analysis sample, I'm thinking, but yeah, there were just all sorts of things like that every single day.
So yeah, following the Olympics, and you mentioned this earlier, you went back to UCLA, continued your studies, you played volleyball there at UCLA, and you were part of the first national championship team too.
Yes.
And of course now there's Title IX, but could you speak to a little bit or talk a little bit about the differences of playing women's college athletics before Title IX?
Well, first of all, obviously we didn't have Title IX then. So if you don't have it, you don't know what you're missing.
Right.
There were no scholarships. There were no, I mean, they supplied, you know, uniforms and things like that. There were no scholarships. There was no endorsements. There was no nothing. We played for the sheer love of it. The university did send us to Florida 1 year for the Nationals, and they put us in a hotel, a motel, that had two queen size beds, and there were three of us per room, none of the three of us were particularly keen on sharing a bed with the other person. So we put the beds together, because when we pulled them apart to put a mattress on the floor, there were many, many little bugs, and none of us wanted to deal with that either. So we managed, fortunately, Laura and I think it was Pigeon, Colleen and myself. And if anything happened during the game, and nobody else knew what this meant, but if anything happened or if one of us made a mistake, the other person on the bench was screaming, "Do that again and you get the crack tonight." So it was a good group. It was very nice. I know there were a couple at first, Sharky Zartman, who was a little intimidated because I'd been at the Olympics and I worked really hard to make that go away. Andy was only a couple years older and just graduated a couple of years before. So he was like one of us. And the camaraderie was thick and genuine. When I went back for the retired jerseys and things, mine, one of them. And that's what Andy said. He said something like it was very different then from now. And I look at those girls and I think, oh, so disciplined and so they've been able to take all the advances in the game and incorporate them and use them. Just like they did after the 64 Olympics when you had Diamatsu, who had a factory team, and he drilled them and drilled them and drilled them. And they were like almost flawless. They could play Pepper for half an hour without a ball going astray. And then the Russians came in with their block in 68. So when you take all these advances and the statistics and the data that they can pull from this, it's really fun for me to watch some of these games and see how much they've advanced and done.
Yeah, it's really cool to see. Yeah, just how the sport has changed with all those influences. Yeah, that's really cool.
Exactly.
How did your experience playing sports, playing volleyball, help you in your career, you know, outside of the court, outside of volleyball?
It taught me perseverance. I was a competitive person. When I got to Architectural Digest, Paige tamped down some of my competitiveness, which I probably needed. But it made me, having been in sports, having made it to the Olympics, it was like, okay, if I have a dream or I have a goal, I can set that goal. If I make it, wonderful. If I don't, that's okay too. But I had a understanding that it was doable, that you could work and persevere and get it. And I was, again, at the right time, at the right place. I traveled to Europe, checking out, what was he, Duke? No, he wasn't a Duke. He was one of those. One of those. His house wasn't good, but his gardens were great. One of our correspondents was Valentine Lawford, who was Winston Churchill's secretary. So, you know, I had lunch with him and he was the one who said, I said, New York is exciting and wonderful. And he said, it It's different when you're here every day without money. I remembered that. So I stayed in California. I did not go to New York. I managed, we used to go to lunch at La Maison. Across the street was Gemini GEL. And I befriended Sid Felsen. Nice, nice man. Very art smart, obviously. And I would go and have lunch with him. And I'd walk in, and I have no idea who's there or what they're pulling, printing, or, you know, it was his job to make sure it was perfect. And sit down, and he'd say, "We're good. Bye." And go across the street and have lunch with me. Gemini GEL has its own niche in art history in the Smithsonian. So I had phenomenal experiences. And at that point, I'm no way say I deserved them. I'm just saying it was like, okay, I can do this. And it was thoroughly expanding. And give me a good sense of independence also.
And taking things back to volleyball for a second, did you watch the 2020 Olympic Games and see the U.S. women win their first gold medal? And if so, what was your reaction?
I was thrilled, absolutely thrilled. And look at these girls and how much they kept stats and stuff on us, but eons and eons ago. But I look at these girls and the self-discipline they have and how they've been able to incorporate all the advances. And I'm sure they trained very hard. But I was just thrilled, thrilled, definitely. You always like to root for them.
Well, and you helped start it all for sure, yeah. to get to them to that point.
I don't know that I think of it that way. I just think of it as building one on top of another, taking those advances and making them work. Because I'm sure there are many advances now in the game that I have no concept of. But it was great fun to watch Mary Jo and Mary Perry as they broke it down, going, okay, try this, do that. And I'm sure they're doing the same thing today. So it's fun to think that they're out there doing the same. There's always a tinge inside me that says, and then I think, no, I best not go out. I think I did go out on the court and do that. I did stop doing Japanese rolls about 10 years ago.
Well, that's impressive.
Yeah, it is. Incredibly impressive.
That's impressive. We noticed that the book is dedicated to your late husband, John.
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about him as we wrap up the interview?
John was my soulmate. I met him when we married when we were 38. Every day was an adventure with John. Before we married, we went to a wedding. And because I'd gone to an all-girls school and was tall, I was always the boy in ballroom dancing. So John never confronted me, just says, "Can I lead for a while?" And I'm like, "Oh my gosh, yes, you can lead for a while." He was, when Christy, our daughter, was 2 years old, he put her on his shoulders and walked into Victoria's Secret and said, "I'm here to buy my daughter a bra." Just watching all the people in the store. Every day was an adventure with him. He was so good natured. He worked at St. John's Hospital in Santa Monica for 46 years, taking x-rays, and people loved him. So he was kind of an inspiration to me. I asked him when we first met, "What's your goal in life?" He said, "To be a good person." He made me a better person. So, and always encouraged me to write. He did tease the bejeebers out of me for having lost my teenage years because I was so serious about volleyball. You just lost your teenage years. You didn't pay attention. But he was never mean. He was always very kind and very giving. So every day was an adventure.
Well, you had some great experiences because of volleyball in those teenage years too. So that's great. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for sharing a little bit about John and of course spending the time here to talk with us about your book and help us get to know you a little bit better. Thank you for that. We appreciate it so much.
Well, thank you, and thank you for looking back with me.
Of course. I love all the stories, and I'm sure you got many, many more too that that people can read about in your book.
My Unusual Life.
Yeah, so where can people find your book? Bookstores.
It's on Amazon, Barnes and Noble, and if I don't have the whole long list, but those are the two main ones that it's on right now. So, at any rate, well, thank you guys. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you so much, and
thank you.
I'm sure we'll talk soon. Yeah.
Great to meet you.
Great to meet you. Yep.
Nice to meet you. Have a good week.
You too.
Thank you. You too.
Bye, Lori.
Bye.
Such an awesome conversation with Lori, a legend in volleyball, legend with USA Volleyball, more specifically as well. And just great to like hear about the early days of volleyball, especially over on the beach side. She had a very, you know, extensive career in beach volleyball as well as indoor. But she, you know, growing up in California, she was there in the beach volleyball boom, talked about, you know, moving beaches too and what that did, moving beaches, gathering more fans as they mm-hmm. as they did that. And
that's crazy.
Yeah, really cool. And hot dog on a stick as well. But and what hot dog on a stick did for the beach volleyball.
I do miss me some hot dog on a stick, man. I mean, she's not wrong.
I've never had it. I never had it.
Is it just a California Maybe. Thing? Is it just one of those?
I think so. I feel like I've seen it. Like I've seen it in California. Like I can Laura see the logo prepared. And everything.
Delicious. So good. Yep. Mm-hmm.
Definitely next time I head out there or I'm in California, I definitely have to check that out. And
I remember she talking about, you know, like on the beach, you know, in those times. But I mean, I remember just walking through the mall as a kid with my with my mom. And I used to always like bug to go over to Hot Dog on a Stick because he had like flavored lemonades and I don't know, it was appealing.
Sounds good.
It was great. Now I'm craving it, you know.
That sounds good. Yeah, I liked little relation on a different level, obviously, because she mm-hmm. played at a much higher level of volleyball than me. But her, when she talked about when driving up to the parking lot, you know, who was playing by mm-hmm. their cars, reminds me of my open gym days.
And yeah, I mean, it's kind of like
my college club you know? Days. Yeah, yeah, yeah. It was really cool.
They set a lot of standards and a lot of, I guess, you know, interactions within the volleyball community that, you know, are still kind of a thing to this day. And, you know, just the fashion trends that they have and just you know, a lot of that stuff. But it was really, really something, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Cool to like also just hear her talk about the transition or the evolution of volleyball, both beach and indoor, from her days playing all the way up until now. And of course, you know, watching the U.S. women's program win their first gold medal in Tokyo as well.
And also figuring out that Wilta still wasn't the best volleyball player. You know, it's insane.
Yep.
Stick to basketball, my guy. No, I'm just kidding. But yeah, you know,
It's a good thing he did.
I know, right? I think he made the right choice. But I mean, I think he made a really good point of just talking about, you know, the Olympic experience and what that meant for the team, what that meant for them personally, and the memories that were created there too. We can't relate to it. You know, we got to live through, you know, their stories like this. And, you know, this is a really good one.
Yeah. I'm so thankful to have Lori on, taking the time to sit down and talk to us and take us through that journey and, you know, the evolution of volleyball and those early days of volleyball, especially on the beach side and learning about that. That's really cool to hear that. I've been to a few beach events and it's wild. Mm-hmm. It's a party. It's a great atmosphere, great energy in that beach community. And it, you know, she painted a really good picture of those early days and just how tight and close that family was, and just where it's come now. It's really cool. Mm-hmm.
I know. Very, very, very cool. But again, thank you again to Lori. Thank you again for taking the time to chat with us. It was really, really, really great learning about your life, the wealth of experience that you've had, and, you know, even you dedicating your book to your late husband. I mean, that's it's all very memorable. And we really thank you for, you know, coming on the podcast, taking the time to just, you know, share from the heart there. As we all as we all are learning about her book, My Unusual Life, just remember you can pick that up for yourself at Barnes & Noble and on Amazon. Now, I think it's time to kick things over with upcoming events with Steven.
Now, we've also just heard that there are hot dogs on a sticks in Texas. Steven, you just missed it out.
Oh, maybe that's where I've seen it.
Maybe not Dallas. I don't know.
All right. Next time I'm in Texas, I'll have to look that up.
All right. Back to events.
Now on to upcoming events. We have three NTDP training series events on December 7th through December 29th. First up, the NTDP Beach Winter Training Series in Manhattan Beach. Also, in Manhattan Beach, we have an NTDP hybrid winter training series as well. And then over in Anaheim, there will be a NTDP indoor training series event. And good luck to all those participants. Congratulations to all those participants as well. And good luck heading out to California. More details on all upcoming events can be found at usavolleyball.org.
Good old sunny Southern California. But on to the pro side of things. First, we have the Norseca U23 Beach Tour from December 11th through the 15th in Guandolio, Dominican Republic. Up next, we have the Norseca Tour Finals from December 14th through the 18th, also in Guandolio. Good luck to all our national team athletes for competing in those events. Best of luck to you. Remember, listeners, you can rate, review, share this podcast with your friends, families, teammates. It really helps this podcast grow and continue to reach new listeners. And remember to check out our video episodes on our website and on YouTube. We always thank you for our continued support. And go USA Volleyball. I'm just kidding. I just want to throw that in there. If you don't have a club that should be featured or a story that you'd love to share, you can email us. You can email us at theusavshow@usav.org. Leave us feedback. Let us know how we're doing. If you want to talk to us at ABCA, we're going to be running around everywhere, but stop and, you know, just hold a conversation. We'd love to hear about anything you either want to talk about on the podcast or in any future episodes as well. Remember, everyone, new episodes drop every other week. And until then, thank you all for listening to the USA Volleyball Show. We are the official podcast of USA Volleyball.
This has been the USA Volleyball Show with Clarence Hughes and Stephen Munson. It's produced by Curtis Ward. Our content producer is Laura Fawcett. Our marketing lead is Bree Jaycox. If you enjoyed this podcast, be sure to rate and review. And if you haven't already, please subscribe to the USA Volleyball Show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts.